Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I want to wish happy Passover to our listeners
who are affected. And what about one for the Christians too?
Yeah, and today's program actually is more Pasqua, which is Easter in Italian. Starting with, in fact, it is all Italian, isn't it? Happy Pasqua.
Happy Pasqua, yeah, sure, yeah. Well, no, there's got to be a different word than happy that goes with that.
Oh, right.
But thinking of a country that is very, very good at celebrating religious holidays, including Christmas, which we've recorded from Rome, as you know, in the past, if you're listeners. But we thought that at Easter would be an excellent time to visit some wines of Italy, and also two excellent contributors to the world of cookbook literature who both have produced wonderful new books on the subject of cooking Italian style in different ways, which we'll get to later in the program.
Now, my first question is, apparently...
Oh, you have a question.
Soave, a particular wine, is actually on the increase in popularity. People are drinking it more, and I'm assuming it probably would go very nicely with ham, if you're having ham.
Yes, if you're having ham for Easter, it's better rush out and buy some Soave if the shop's still open, because we had a very authoritative guest.
He's so good, yeah.
Telling us all about what was a much-abused white wine from the north of Italy, one which is now coming back to favor again, and... here's someone to explain why that's happening.
We're welcoming Giovanni Ponchia from where in Italy are you, Giovanni?
I'm in a small medieval town that is called Soave in northern Italy, between Verona and Venice.
Nice area, very nice area.
And not only is it a beautiful town, it's a beautiful wine, listeners, and if you are not familiar with that, you are soon going to find out perhaps more than you ever wanted to know.
Giovanni, you are in charge of the Soave Consortium.
Correct.
And you are an enologist as well.
Fine, correct, I'm an enologist.
The press release we got said that there was this revival of interest on the part of American drinkers, but I'm assuming that there are others around the globe, too, who have rediscovered the wine called Soave.
That's what we hope.
Yes, well, anyhow, well, we like it. Could you possibly tell our listeners about the grapes and what makes Soave?
Soave, next Soave style, is a potpourri of different expressions, of different styles, all made up with a single, the same variety, that is the Garganega, a very difficult to be pronunciated by Americans, I know.
Garganega? That's
okay. Garganega, yes. Garganega. The queen of our area, and there are more than 100 different producers here that are year by year increasing their quality, and now Soave became, after 20 years, the most recognized Italian wines, talking about the white varieties. Soave is the one that wins always year by year the largest number of prizes, and it's also the most produced white wine that we have in Italy.
Now, Giovanni, the grape is a native grape from that region?
It's an indigenous variety that is present only here. That's because the Garganega needs a particular microclimate, not so cold, not so hot, and then needs another particularity, that is the volcanic soil. The Garganega arrives here more than 2,000 years ago, and will be the Greek. I think that were the Greek populations that bring this variety from the Middle East. And the variety that grows only here in Soave, and this volcanic soil is very completely black, and when you don't see other black stones, you start to find out other red varieties. That's because in Italy we say that the red wines need white soils and the white wines need black soils.
Cute.
Now, the neighboring red wines in your region are the ones of the Valpolicella region, correct?
Yes, it's very close from here. Soave and Valpolicella are the two big producers in Italy, are two different areas, different for the soils, but also very close. Specialized, Valpolicella produced only red wines and Soave only white wines.
Now, if we go back maybe 25 years or so in the United States, yeah. I think it would be fair to say from our perspective, and I'm sure this is something you've been working very hard on, Valpolicella was a red wine which had a poor reputation, and Solave was a white wine that had a poor reputation.
Right.
And so they might have been large in volume sales, but they were not being bought and drunk by very sophisticated wine drinkers. And obviously you've been working very hard to change that.
Yes, that's what we are trying to do. So they changed a lot of style. In that period there were only 1, 2, 3 different producers. Now things have changed. There are 3,000 growers in Suave. There are more than 100 small producers that point, that focuses their attention only to quality. And so it's very, very easy here to find great white wines that can age for 8, 10, 15 years. And with a very interesting point of price that is very important in Italy and also in USA. And the image of Suave is very different from what you remember in the 60s, in the 70s, thanks to God.
Okay, so I am right, and I'm glad that God's on our side. Now, I did want to ask another question from the enological standpoint. The background material we got said that there is some use of Trebbiano grapes in Suave. To what extent is that true?
Well, we must say a thing. Till 50, 60 years ago, Suave was completely covered by white varieties. But Garganega, at that period, represented 50% of the entire vineyard. The other 50% was the Trebbiano, but with different period of maturation. And so the growers in that period chose the Garganega that was more generous and less sensible to humidity and to the botrytis. What's changing now? We find out in the last 15 years the old clones of the Trebbiano and planted separately and with different cares can give a very interesting product. Now represented the 2% of the entire Suave vineyard, but it's going to increase. I think that we reach the 5% of the Suave vineyard in 10 years. What can give the Trebbiano to the final product, to the Suave, is a good, I think that is an interesting acidity, is a good flavor of orange, of citrus sensations, and always also a nice apricot inside the Suave is the traditional blend, a bit of Trebbiano. But you know, if the Garganega is the mother in all the family, not ever there is a father, you know.
Right. Now there are four different classifications, I guess I would say, in Suave. I think there's a straight Suave DOC, there's a Suave Classico, there's a Suave Superiore, and then there's a Recioto di Suave. Can you explain the distinction between those?
Yes, it's a classification made up by the pedological situation. The Suave DOC can be produced, is the base of the quality pyramid that we have in Suave, and it can be produced in the flat plain, you know. In the flat plain there are four different valleys inside the Suave areas. When you start to move to the hillside area, to the hillside between the municipalities of Suave and Monteforte, you find the geographical classical area recognized in 1931 such as the class, the Chianti Classico. And then you can produce the Suave Classico only in this small area. If you wanted to produce the Suave Superiore, the DOCG, you have to remain in the hilly area but with lower yields of grapes in the harvest. Varieties using the same areas but with lower yields and with different training system that are the pergolas for the Suave DOC and the Suave Classico. Pergolas such as a tent. For the Suave Superiore, you have to use the Guyot training system, and this is the top of the pyramid. Then, in the same place, always remaining in the hilly area, you can do harvest 1 or 2 weeks before of the normal harvest, picking up the best grapes and getting it dried for 4, 5, 6 months and starting the fermentation in February and March and obtaining a very interesting sweet wine that is called Recioto di Suave, one of the most ancient that we have in Italy.
So this is, in a way, it's a little bit like what the red
wine makers in Valpolicello make, which is an Amarone, except that it's specialized to be a sweet wine rather than be a regular.
It was more similar to Recioto della Valpolicella. The Amarone is youngest than the Recioto della Valpolicella, and the Recioto di Soave are very, very ancient. Amarone was born 15 years ago. The Recioto di Soave and Recioto della Valpolicella, we have proofs of testify the existence of these two wines from the 685, 685 after Christ, so 1,005 centuries ago.
Oh, okay. Now, I was thinking that the drying of the grapes is, you have that in common between the Recioto and the Amarone. But then, you're saying we're also trying to make, we're trying deliberately to make a Vincento style sweet wine.
Correct, it's a natural process of drying the grapes that normally go on for 4 or 6 months in order to concentrate, to lose the water inside the clusters, inside the berries.
Now there are two different means of, if you like, wine production. In Soave, if I'm remembering correctly, we discussed before, a large quantity of Soave that reaches the market is made by cooperatives of grape growers who need a place where they can work together to produce wine. And then you have a lot of small producers who go independently to market making their own wine.
Yes, yes. There are about 2,800 growers that bring their grapes to the cooperative sellers that are very organized and that are very important for the area. You know, in Italy we have a lot of beautiful places, but only in Soave and in other two, three other places, the vineyards, the cultivation of the vines stopped the advance of the industrialization. So only in Piedmont and in Soave we preserve our areas from the other cultivation or other activities. The cooperative sellers were very important in the last 50 years to maintaining the remuneration for the grapes and giving hope to the producer, to the growers, to go on with this activity. And now we are in the biggest viticulture garden that we have in Italy.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, we tried two samples which were sent to us courtesy of your agent in the United States, and one was a Soave DOC Classico Rocca Sveva 2009, which we very much enjoyed. That seemed to us to have a very pleasant acidic edge, which the old style Soave would never have presented. And then we had one that I think of the two was my favorite, a Soave DOC from a producer called Danieli, also 2009.
A very small producer.
That's a very small producer. Now the other one, Rocca Sveva, is a larger producer?
Rocca Sveva is the boutique winery of Cantina di Soave.
Okay. All right. So
Rocca Sveva is a small part of Cantina di Soave that select the growers. Only 100 growers can bring there the grapes. And very close from me now, only 200 meters, is just under the Soave cartel, Rocca Sveva. A very nice place with a lot of tourists year by year. Well, Fattori produced no more of 200,000 bottles. It's a small producer that in the last year stopped to experimentate the Sauvignon, the Pinot Grigio and other white varieties, and now he would like only to produce Soave. He never stopped to produce Soave, but he's falling in love another time, and now he produces three or four different versions of Soave. You see, Classico, etc.
It sounds like it's a very exciting time.
Yeah, no, we reached the, we think that it's a good variety, very versatile, the Garganega. You can have an interesting sparkling wine, you can do interesting still wine, aged in oak also, or aged in stainless steel, with interesting apricot peach flavors, and the enologists and the winemakers now are proposing four different expressions of the Soave. It's very nice. It's fuller interest now for this variety.
Well, we made a big mistake when we were in Verona. And instead of stopping in Soave, we went to part of a straight along the Autostrada, but we did wave to Soave. We could see it in the middle distance away from the road, and next time we come to the region, we're not going to make the same mistake. Now, we did go to Vicenza. We loved the visit to Vicenza. And who's the wonderful architect who created a lot of the buildings? Palladio.
Palladio, right.
And So listeners, when you go to Soave, because you certainly should, when you go to Vicenza, which you certainly should, when you go to Verona, which you certainly should, remember to notice in the countryside around Absolutely. That whole region are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Palladio-designed buildings.
Which, yes, that are very concentrated in Vicenza and Padova. Also.
But there are some just out in the middle of the fields as well.
The Veneto was completely full of cultivation till 1960, and then there was a bit of industrial revolution, but most of the architectural jewels that we have are completely inside of the nature of the cultivations.
I think you're a lucky man. I feel very jealous that you are sitting in Soave looking out at the castle and the vineyards. And we are sitting in the city of Pittsburgh looking out at a street with buses and cars driving down it.
I think the same. No, I lived in other places in Italy, such as Montalcino or Friuli in the Collio. But only here I fall in love. I don't know why, but it's a very romantic and particular places of Italy. And now I work here from since 2004, and it's very difficult to go away from here. Believe me. I can only invite you here the next time to come in Italy.
You better be careful, because when we get invited, we show up.
Giovanni, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. And listeners, those of you who, like us, 25 years ago didn't like Soave, you have to revisit it very soon. You'll enjoy. You will not be disappointed. You'll be pleased that you did. Giovanni, thank you so much for joining
thank
us today.
You.
Grazie mille, Giovanni.
buon proseguimento qui. Now here it's night. I hope to read you and hear you again.
Okay, indeed.
Buona serata.
And anche lei.
Stay with us while we take a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and next up we have a totally delightful woman who we've had on the show before, who comes from an illustrious Italian wine family. It's Tiziano Frescobaldi.
And we're counterpointing here on wine, because Tiziano, like many people, believes that the first duty of a wine is to be red, especially at Easter, so you'll hear that her views somewhat conflict with the representative Soave, but that's fine. I guess there's room in the world for both. So Tiziana Frescobaldi talking about celebrating Easter with wine in her family.
Buongiorno, Tiziana.
Buongiorno.
Yes. I'm so glad to be talking to you. Tiziano Frescobaldi of the very famous wine family. When was it we saw you? Is it... 2 years ago?
No, it was just it was last recent, actually. Yeah, it was last October.
Yeah, that's right. You came to Nipozzano. To Castello di Nipozzano.
We did.
Yes.
A terrible thing happened later in our trip as we were coming home. We had carefully placed the wonderful olive oil that you gave us in our suitcase together with one of the two splendid bottles of red wine that we acquired on our trip, and somebody stole them from our suitcase. Can you believe that?
No.
Isn't that just an awful thing?
Yeah, well, you know, you're not allowed to lock your suitcases.
So I guess...
Right.
So
did they steal anything else?
No. That was all.
No, fortunately, we drank the wonderful bottle of wine that you gave us the evening before we left Italy.
I'm sorry to hear this.
But the people at Castello Banfi gave us a bottle of their wonderful wine, and that was gone.
That is just amazing. That, I mean, I guess whoever stole it must have a luggage handler with good taste.
But anyway, that's not the reason that we're talking today.
No.
Somebody got in touch with us and said, how about we do a little interview about the wonderful art of wine pairing, especially in a time of the year when it might be difficult. And with Easter coming up, there are some traditional foods that are served in Italian households. Tiziana, why don't you tell us first about what is typical there?
food?
What is typical here in Italy, one, we used to have lamb during the Easter time, which I think goes well with wines, like maybe it can go well with Nipozzano, it can go quite well also with Tenuta di Castiglioni, and both those two wines, the Castello di Nipozzano, the Nipozzano Riserva, and the Tenuta di Castiglioni, Frescobaldi wines, in my view, are very quite the right choice to go with this kind of meat, because I honestly think that the taste of the meat can really pair itself very well with both those two wines. It can balance. So I would choose one of the two.
Well, I have one
in
of
any
the,
case.
I have one of the two in front of me. So I guess if we have lamb for Easter, we'll know that 2007 Nipozzano Riserva will be absolutely perfect.
It would work at least.
What about in our previous correspondence? Somebody mentioned that, Easter is a time for families, and Easter is a time when family members who are not necessarily have the best wine palate in the world. If someone said, "But I only drink white wine," what would you do with the lamb? Would you say to have chicken instead?
If they only drank white wine, it's good, because I would recommend maybe like a Pomino Bianco on any sort of like chicken or maybe if they would have fish even. So Pomino Bianco, I think, would go with a lot of poultry and, of course, fish. And I would drink Pomino Bianco with pasta. And for any first course, I think would go very well with the white ones, with Pomino Bianco. So I think it's a very good way to start your meal. And if anyone doesn't drink red wine, which is quite a shame in some ways, but I understand, you can, go through a full meal with the whites. And I'm sure that we also have a bottle of Pomino Bianco goes well, and a Pomino Beneficio if you need a white, which is a little bit more structured, a little bit very, very complex white wine from Tuscany, the Pomino Beneficio is probably a very good choice. But I would stick to Pomino Bianco in any case, because I think it's a very versatile wine. So I would strongly recommend that wine. And it's a very, at the same time, it's quite, has a very nice and elegant nose with a lot of different aromas, so I think it's a very, I always have fun drinking Pomino Bianco, so I think it's honestly a good choice.
Now, does Frescobaldi make a sparkling wine at all?
Yes, we make a sparkling wine. As a matter of fact, we make two sparkling wines. One, which is the Frescobaldi Brut, and we produce that in Italy, and the other one is Prosecco, called Prosecco Danzante. And those two are our sparkling wines. But we only produce quite a limited quantity of those wines. You're more likely to find a Pomino Bianco rather than a Frescobaldi Brut or a Danzante Prosecco. But anyhow, we produce those wines because we like also to be in, have a little bit of our production in the sparkling world.
Yeah. Sure, but it's always a great way to start off a meal. But some of the previous correspondents mentioned a glazed ham as being kind of something that was quite typical, but might be a challenge to pair a wine with.
Yes.
What would you do there? Something that has a lot of sweetness associated with the meat. What way would you go there?
I would always go, actually, with the meat, with a red wine.
Okay.
I have to admit.
No,
we're
together in that. We have one friend who's a winemaker who says the first duty of a wine is to be red. I think it sounds like you agree with him.
Now tell us.
Yes, no doubt. I mean, with meat, I would, anything is a good choice if you like it, in my view, but there's a sort of chemistry that works much better with the red, the meat and the red. Those two are an excellent combination, especially if, they can, quality of the two elements are there's a sort of, you know, balance between the quality.
Now, you have a large family. What do you usually do? What are your plans for this Easter, Tiziana?
So, actually, yes, this Easter, I think I will probably, we will have a first course. It will be with my family, and we'll be probably celebrating in Rome, because my two sisters live in Rome, so I will probably join them and we'll all be in Rome. And I think we will decide what to put on the first course, which would probably be a white wine, and then we'll go for the meat, and that would be probably, since it's, you know, Easter only comes once a year, that would have to be an important wine. So I might decide between Castel Giocondo, Brunello di Montalcino.
Oh, wow.
I would go on that wine. Yeah, I think I would stick to the Castel Giocondo, Brunello di Montalcino. Many reasons, because I think it is an excellent combination with red meat, or whatever the red meat is. I think it really works well. And also because I like to celebrate Easter with a good bottle of Brunello di Montalcino. The one we produce is the Castel Giocondo, you know, so I will suggest that to my family. I think they will agree on that.
maybe you even bring some to convince them.
No, well, you know, I mean, it's not too hard to convince them. I have a lot of, you know, problems on other issues, but not on this.
now we had a very interesting experience. By now, it must be probably 12 or 13 years ago. We were in Italy on Easter Sunday, and we chose for lunch to go to a religious property, which was associated with the Franciscan order. I can't remember the name of it. I remember the town was called Cetona, C-E-T-O-N-A.
Yes, Cetona,
And they had a wonderful program there called Mondo X, which took delinquent young people off the streets of the cities of Italy and put them into a restaurant training program, and it was an excellent restaurant.
Yeah.
Well, we were there Easter Sunday, and sitting at the next table was a family, it turned out, the entire family Nonino. Perhaps you know them from the wonderful grappas that they make.
And that's right, yes, absolutely.
And it turned
fantastic.
Out we got into conversation with them, and we said, no, because we were alone, we said we would love to take some photographs of an Italian family at Easter. And they had a small child who was perhaps a year and a half old, and they took the bow off the huge Italian Easter egg, tied the bow around the little girl's head. She wasn't too keen on that, but we did get some charming photos, and it turned out that their designated photographer's photographs never came out. So I sent them all of ours, and they were so delighted.
It was fun to see the traditions, especially the dessert, which was from Milan, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, they brought one of those
cakes.
It's like a paloma. It's like it's the shape of a dove, and
it's a colomba.
A colomba.
Right.
Yes.
And a very famous pastry place in Milan.
And they had brought it all the way to Umbria for Easter.
Yes. Yeah, I love colomba, and I think we'll also have that.
There you go.
So
now you'll be dining in at a family property in Rome. You won't be going out.
We'll be dining at home.
Wonderful. That's wonderful.
No,
well,
I think it's.
We wish we could join you, but. I'm sure we can.
You have time to decide just a few days.
and we know you're off to in Italy later this week, so we hope that you'll have a wonderful time there, and
thank you.
Make lots of connections, and sell lots of wine, and win lots of prizes.
Thank you so much. I really hope that it's going to be a good year for the Vinitaly, and that it will have some interesting contacts and interesting wines to taste. So I really hope that it will work out well for all the people that are visiting in Italy, and I hope that they will also come to visit us and maybe taste some of our wines. Might as well, if you're going to be there, just take the opportunity and come and taste some of our wines at the Frescobaldi Boot, which is located in the Tuscan area. Yeah. So it's of course, you know, Vinitaly is a huge place, but
huge
this
event,
is what
right.
makes it interesting is because all the Italian wine world gathers once a year.
Right.
So.
Now, what about your website?
www.frescobaldi.it. So it's easy.
Okay, very good. Well, I was thinking anybody who was going to be in Italy who wanted to do a tasting could go online to find out what the requirements are and how you go about setting up an appointment for
yes.
a tasting.
Of course, you're very welcome to do so. So, of course.
Okay.
We'll be here. And
we had a wonderful time. We just enjoyed your company enormously. So did I.
So this is the reason, because
the food was great, the wines were wonderful, and it was a charming lunch. Enjoyed it very much. Grazie mille.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Anne, so much.
Until the next time we're in Italy, huh?
Yes.
Thank you so much, Tiziana.
I look forward to that.
Definitely. Yeah, me too.
Thank you. Have a nice Easter.
And you too.
Stay with us. We'll be right back after this brief commercial announcement.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Our next two guests are going to be interesting for those of you who like Italian cooking, Italian cookbooks from two very different perspectives. The first up would be Chef Johnny Scapin, Italian Cooking at Home from the Culinary Institute of America. So this is a very authoritative book.
Not only that, but the author has a restaurant too in the general neighborhood of the CIA.
Yeah.
Which is a place we're certainly going to have to go by sometime.
Yeah, well, let's listen to Johnny. We have before us a book that's going to make anyone listening to this program, if you look at this book, so famished, hungry for good Italian food. The author is Chef Johnny Scapin.
Yes, Johnny Scapin. Yes.
Scapin. And who is Italian? He's from Venezia.
Close to Venice, yes.
Close to. The book is from the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America. I mean, they produced it, and he wrote it, and with a couple of other authors and photographers, and it's just amazing, Italian cooking at home. Welcome, Johnny. This is a wonderful book, and you cover all of Italy in this?
Yes, pretty much. It was me with another chef, Chef Vanoli, which is also an instructor, and Stephen Colpan is a wine connoisseur.
Oh, right.
And is the person who helped us to put together some wine notes all along. Each recipe, if you notice, there is a wine notes on the bottom.
Right.
They make it very easy for whoever is cooking, picking up a good wine, decent wine that can go with the food.
Now, Stephen's been on the program before because he did a book with some colleagues at CIA, particularly on wine.
Yes, yes. So, Wine Explorer, every 2 years, there's a beautiful encyclopedia about Wine Explorer.
That's the one we have.
I'm always interested in Italian cooking at home because I grew up with Italian cooking at home, although my family was Sicilian, so it's a little bit different. These are supposed to be classics. Is that what you're trying to get
yes,
to?
Yes, we put a lot of the classic recipe, easy to follow, and then we have a few that is a little, some of them are challenging, but just in case you want to just enjoy yourself for 3 or 4 hours, you can spend that amount of time, but most of them, they're pretty easy. Just put them together very easily. There's a lot of suggestion. And talking about Sicily, there is one probably you recognize as your family, the stuffed grilled swordfish, you know, the involtini di pesce.
Yes, right, yes, right. Indeed.
Yeah, that's typical Sicilian. So we do have a lot of southern, especially because northern cuisine is embracing the southern cuisine finally.
Oh yeah, everybody seems to be favoring.
Yeah, better for you. We don't use as much butter when we cook, but more olive oil. So we are changing, you know, like any other way of cooking. But we stay with the basic, very sincere basic when we cook. You know, good stock, good product. Of course, Italian food is all about great product. You have a good product, there's only so much you can do to mess it up.
Now, you have a teaching position at the Culinary Institute of America. You have a restaurant, which you should tell us about in just a moment. But you wrote this book for people to cook at home. Now, how is that different in your view?
Oh, talking about restaurant and cooking at home? Well,
right. Yes.
When you're in the restaurant, you know, you have a dishwasher who help you to wash dishes. You have a help. So sometimes your life is pretty easy as a chef because everybody else is cleaning after you. But when you cook at home, kind of a pain in the neck if you don't organize yourself properly. At the end of when you're done cooking, you might have a mess. So some of these recipes, they're pretty simple enough. When you have a nice saucepan or a pot and a couple of utensils, you can put them together and that's it.
So you really simplified it.
Yes, I did. Like, for example, if you look at the soup, we have the old egg drop soup, the stracciatella alla romana, typical Jewish soup. We have a zuppa pavese, just two yolks on the top of a piece of bread, and then you pour the hot broth on the top so the yolks kind of cook with the pecorino. And many others, so simple to put together that at the end, when you go and taste it, you say, oh, God, just a broth and a couple of eggs, and that could be your meal in one evening.
Now, I do remember, Gianni, having lunch with a family in Abruzzo. And grandmother cooked, and grandmother never came anywhere near the table. Grandmother was in the kitchen. So I'm guessing if it was cooking for an Italian at home,
yes,
the book would be a little different, huh?
Yes, a little bit. But I have to say, most of our recipes, they're pretty, instead of going ahead, try to be, to create new food, I'm trying actually to go back. I mean, I'm almost 50, and I'm almost kind of memories, probably you remember. I try to go back and remember what my grandmother, my mother used to cook, and that's what I love cooking.
So you're nostalgic, I guess.
Yeah, it's been an evolution for me. Since I came to America, you know, probably 25 years ago, you try to create new things, the presentation. Now I'm kind of going back. The simpler, the better. It's all about good ingredients, good olive oil, the basic of good Italian cooking, and you are already ahead of everybody else. Look at the pasta e ceci, for example. Pasta with chickpea.
Oh,
nobody do that anymore. They don't do anymore.
Oh, I remember that from my childhood.
Yeah. They think, why would I eat pasta and chickpea? But when you put them together and you eat, it's so satisfying. Or pasta e lento. Lento with pasta, for me, I love those things.
Now, Peter had a question. We have your burrito misto.
Well, it's actually a several-part question. So this is the first, it's really an observation, is about the organizing of the book. Because you have it organized in what would seem to be very neat categories.
Yes.
And desserts are at the end, right behind the desserts. I mean, right before the desserts are the meat dishes. Right before that, we have the seafood dishes. But burrito misto,
yes,
which many people would say is the ultimate meat dish, is in the burrito.
Yes, exactly. Because, see, you made a burrito misto, so for 3 or 4 days, if you're savvy, you can actually have the meal for 4 days. Because with burrito misto, you eat on Sunday. Then you have leftover the broth, a lot of broth. They can, for 2 or 3 days, you can make a risotto, you can make a simple soup, you can do some dumpling there. And then you have the meat leftover. They can be reheated, or you can do little polpette, which is
meatballs.
The poor version of meatball without using raw meat. You actually have the cooked meat, cooked that you just grind it up,
right,
mixed with some parmigiano, one egg to hold it together, and there you go.
Now, here is my next question, because you associate the dish with the first king of Italy, Victor Emmanuel, mm-hmm, and you associate it with Piemonte. Yet when we were in Trieste, in Friuli Venezia Giulia, they said burrito misto is the dish of here, and the reason it's the dish of here is because of the connection of our city to the Austro-Hungarian Holy Roman Empire.
Yes.
So what's the right answer?
It's one of those things. You ask somebody from Piemonte, they say it's there. It's like tiramisu. I say it's from Veneto. You go to Lombardia, they say it's from Lombardia. So unless you start...
Sicilians think of it as theirs, too.
So you're never going to know. And Italian people in general, they do like to complicate everything. Look at the variety of the rice that we have to make risotto.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. You go to a supermarket in Italy, I mean, you don't even know which one you choose. In America, you find Carnaroli or Arborio. So there's only so much you can mess it up making a good risotto. In Italy, if you don't know the category, all the rices, it could become a little a nightmare unless you speak a little bit of Italian.
Now, I'm interested in this puntarelle.
Puntarella.
With the anchovy dressing. We've had this many times in Rome or near Rome, and I keep ordering the seeds to grow this stuff, and it never comes out to be what it was that we found in Rome.
Yeah, I guess it's like trying to put a good grape that you had in Italy in America. It won't come up. You know, it's one of those things. But it's a wild secret. Sometimes I replace it with escargot, or when you find them or you grow them yourself, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And I agree, it's one of those things, mystery. I don't even know. I do the same thing. I try to plant in my garden, and they didn't come out. Or they were too tiny, or they turned too big, and they were not even good at all. They were not crazy
enough. Yeah, that's what I get.
Yeah.
I gave up.
It could be the soil. But
it's fabulous.
Chicory works well. Or another one that would work very well is dandelion, or even I like with the lacinato kale.
Tried that too. That
Tosca kale, yes.
Yeah.
The black kale, yes.
Yeah. That we grow, but it still's not the same as what you get in Italy.
that's the one they call cavallo.
Yeah, in Toscana or
in Toscana, don't
they? Cavallo nero.
Cavallo nero. It always sounds like it ought to be something about a horse.
Yes, close. Almost the same spelling.
But this food is, you understand why people are in love with Italian food when they see your book.
Oh, thank you.
Bring out the best qualities of it.
Thank you very much. And we had an amazing photographer. He's also an Italian guy, Francesco Tonelli. Uh-huh. He does a lot of photography for the New York Times. And he's an amazing chef who all of a sudden changed career because he had a family to stay home at night. And he became a photographer. And this is the first book with us, photography with the CIA. And I have to say,
mustn't get away from the book without referring again to Steve Colpan,
yes,
who did the wonderful wine pairings with every dish. So he's got a suggestion of one or more ways to go with an Italian wine to go with each and every one of the dishes. So he's doing a great service there, especially for people who are not familiar with some of the best wines in Italy.
I agree.
We're beyond straw bottle Chianti and stuff like that.
And he made it simple enough that you don't have to stay there reading too much, because sometimes people want to know a little bit of the wine, and there you go. And that's what I like about it, this wine little note he did.
Here we go. We must have you tell us about your restaurant.
Right, yes, I was just about to say.
My restaurant is in Woodstock, New York, where they did a concert many years ago. And it's right at the beginning of the town, so you cannot miss it. An old yellow Victorian house, and the sign's right there, nice parking. We have about 120 seats with a patio. And we remodel, and it's super, super charming, very casual, but there's a little bit of sophistication when you get into the bar. So you can be in jeans and sneakers, but still feel that you are in a very warm, great service, food. That's what you see on the book, pretty much. So not too expensive. So we like to be very casual, especially because we're outside New York City. We don't need to charge the same price because our rent is very good.
You know? No, you forgot to mention what it's called.
Cucina.
Cucina.
Just simple
Cucina.
Kitchen.
There you go.
Cucina Woodstock, that's it.
It's like that restaurant.
Cucina Woodstock.
It's like that restaurant in London called Rasoi.
Yeah. Exactly.
Rasoi is Indian for kitchen.
Now, do you have a website that people should go to?
CucinaWoodstock.com.
www.CucinaWoodstock.com.
Cucina Woodstock.
Okay.
Yes. If you Google, easy to find. And
you make your Italian accent, sounds Woodstock. It makes Woodstock sound so wonderfully mysterious. which it certainly wasn't.
Yeah, it was not at all.
You know, I had a question since you're from near Venice. Why are there not great restaurants in Venice? It's one of the biggest tourist draws in Italy.
Yeah, and it's almost like going to 42nd Street in New York City. It's the same thing. It's a trap. It's like a tourist trap.
Yeah, but that's it.
If you have the chance to go, you should try to go to Osteria da Fiore.
Oh, we've been there several times. Yeah,
Mara.
That was good.
Wonderful chef, but of course it is expensive.
It's hard to get into.
Yeah, very expensive, but it's one of my favorite. Or El Barcon. It means the big nasty house. There's also a nice, but El Barcon. Great seafood, super, super simple. Service okay, very family style. Sometimes it can be a little rough, but food is pretty good. But the rest, I agree with you.
Well, there you go. Well, then, just remember that, listeners. Even the great Gianni, who comes from there, doesn't know where he can get a really good meal in Venice. So don't be surprised if you can't either.
Yeah, we just gave up, Gianni.
Yeah, that's why when people ask me, I say, you want to be safe, get yourself a panino or a pizza.
There you go.
By the way, it still costs you $20, but because it's expensive. So at the end, you know that, you know, you're safe.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Johnny. I hope to see you someday.
And we'll talk to you on the other side of this brief commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And next stop, still in the theme of Italian cooking, and it's at home, but in this case, it's cooking with Italian grandmothers.
In their homes.
In their homes. And what fun Jessica Thoreau must have had with this project, which took about a year and a half. Let's hear her tell us about it. Well, I'm not surprised that there was such a demand for this book, Cooking with Italian Grandmothers, by Jessica Thoreau. You had to do a second printing, like right out of the gate, and because I had to wait a long time to get the review copy of this, Jessica, but it is certainly an amazing accomplishment.
Thank you, Anne.
And you did everything in it. You did, I mean, the photography is mouth-watering. It's just absolutely spectacular. And you did that, too. Yeah, you did the writing. You planned your whole trip. You explain this project. Why don't I let you just do that?
So it started with a grant that I received from Brown University upon graduation to go and document food traditions in Italy for a year. And the grant was really for films. So I went there, and Brown was really great in that they said, go have a good process. We don't care about product so much, but go and explore. We trust your instincts, basically. And so I flew to Italy with a few contacts and began this process of really looking into how food traditions, culinary traditions, and agricultural traditions, but mostly culinary traditions, are being maintained in Italy. And really, you know, ended up finding that the most enjoyable and meaningful way for me to spend my time documenting those traditions was by living and cooking with grandmothers all over the country.
Did this for a year?
Yeah, it ended up being about a year and a half. The grant was for a year. And so it became films first. There's a series of four films that can be found, links to it on the book's website, which is cookingwithitaliangrandmothers.com. And then one of the films was picked up by a couple publishing houses. I ended up going with Welcome Books. And
which is interesting because they're brand new to this culinary book thing.
Right, yeah. I really loved their...
Aren't they nice?
Their sort of art sensibility, their design and art sensibility, and that made sense for me because I have an arts background, and that was important to me to have a book that was designed well and really did justice to the work and to these women's lives.
Now, Jessica, you've been to Italy before. This was not your first time there.
I had,
You write about an experience of a grandmother you were related to, I guess?
An au pair,
It was au pair's mother, right.
So I visited her and stayed with her when I was four for a few weeks while my parents were traveling around Italy, and have some pretty vivid memories of her very comforting foods while I was there. And then again for Graziella, my au pair's wedding. And then actually when I graduated from high school, I grew up in England, and when I graduated from high school, a friend of mine and I drove from London through France and Italy for about 6 weeks.
Yeah, I caught that accent. It sounds a little bit Irish.
Yeah, there's that in my background too.
Yeah, I'm not bad. you began your life in England, but then you found
I was born. I was actually born in the States, but yeah, moved to England when I was one. So largely raised in London.
Well, are your family's English or American?
They're American. Yeah, okay. We moved over from my dad's work,
and you just happened to get an Italian au pair.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay. Which began this whole journey.
But now you picked Italy for a particular reason. Wanted to explore the cooking of a country that really placed such an intense passion around cooking.
Definitely, yeah. I had been a healing foods cook for many years. I was sick as a child with some pretty severe digestive problems and had ended up healing myself at a very young age with food and herbs. And so had gone on to study during some time off from Brown, had studied healing foods traditions and cooking. And so was sort of very versed that, knew that there was something missing from those systems. And that thing was, you know, how is food connected to family? How is it connected to the land? How is it pleasure? How is it community? All of these things that Italy does so well.
Yeah, it does.
And that I knew I wanted rounded out in my experience of food and cooking.
Well, that is true. I mean, I think that would be a natural to choose, certainly. At the time, it would not be natural to choose London. But anyhow, so I think it's kind of amazing. We talked a little bit about language, and you said that you actually were not up to speed in language until you got there, and then you had to be a quick study.
Yeah, because grandmothers, many of them didn't even speak Italian. They spoke in dialect. And so at least having an understanding, a deep understanding of the Italian language was important. And so that happened pretty quickly. Irene, who's the third woman in the book, she spoke a bit of English and Italian, obviously, and had been a teacher at one point. And so I learned so much with her, really. Uh-huh. She was a great teacher of mine. We got to practice a lot together. But a lot of it was just really a matter of survival and needing to really wanting to accomplish what I had gone there to do, and so needing to learn the language immediately.
Well, didn't Italians think, these women think it was really peculiar that this person was coming and knocking on their door to say, I want to come in and cook with you?
They did, yeah. I think that at first they were a little taken aback. I think for two reasons. First of all, because I was this young woman traveling around alone, which was incomprehensible to them, from another country. And then beyond that, you know, they had never really had anyone pay attention to what they were doing.
Right.
It was just their way of life. So it was strange to them at first that someone was taking such interest in it. So for those reasons, but you know, it was so sweet, because once I spent, you know, even a half an hour with them, there was this opening up, and they started to see themselves differently. Like, I think that whole process with them, which has culminated in them receiving copies of the book, has been one where they're actually seeing the importance and the value of what was just very normal for them, mm-hmm, in their lives.
But they opened up on all kinds of fronts to you, like the woman who had the out-of-wedlock son that she didn't,
right,
talk to anybody about except to you.
Right.
So there is, you discovered this connection that you can create in the kitchen as two women just cooking together, right?
Yes, it's quite profound at times. Her story, Giovanna's story, was very moving.
Now, this book is a great book on two different levels, and I think I'd like you to just go into, expand a little bit on both of those. One is, it's a series of snapshots of it.
It came down to 12 women. We didn't even say that.
Okay. But it's like through those 12 women, you make a snapshot of Italian home cooking.
Right.
So the book is a wonderful read, just if you're interested in that, even if you're not, even if you're not interested in actually learning to cook the recipes.
Right.
But at the same time, you have a fundamentally sound Italian cookbook of economical, readily available foodstuffs that you've,
right,
also contributed as well. So you got both of those. Was that all you were trying to do, or is there more?
Those were the sort of two main things. Another huge piece of this for me was really the whole experience was one of learning to trust my instincts. And so in a way, it's kind of a very subtle call for people to do that. There's something that they're passionate about, to go and do it, to follow their instincts, to follow their taste buds, for me in the case of Italy, and really to trust themselves and what they're interested in and where that might lead. With this project, in very, very tangible ways, it led me to pretty incredible places, both while I was in Italy and both with all that's happened with the material since then and how it's being received. And so there's that kind of personal journey woven into it. And, you know, I hope that it's sort of inspirational to people in that way.
Well, I think it's a huge achievement. And let me give you an example of why I think that. We've had, as a recent guest on the program, twice, in fact, Coleman Andrews, who, mm-hmm, wrote a book about Ferran Adria, which was received with mixed signals, but wrote a book called The Country Cooking of Ireland.
Right.
You'll be interested in that association since you have some roots there. But the curious thing is that he did The Country Cooking of Ireland as a trial run. What they had actually asked him to do was The Country Cooking of Italy following in a series where Anne Willen, a great cook, author and chef, she did the companion volume, The Country Cooking of France. He said when the publisher asked me to do The Country Cooking of Italy, I said, it's going to be too difficult. Let me do a trial run on The Country Cooking of Ireland. So what he's saying, I mean, he's a very accomplished author and a very accomplished food person. And he said The Country Cooking of Italy would be much too difficult. But you just decided to take it on anyway.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I really took it on through these relationships with these women and through these individual lives. I wasn't really seeking to do an encyclopedia of Italian country cooking, but it's more like what are the lives behind the cooking and how the food and the individuals and the larger communities and culture is all woven together, so almost doing these personal portraits. It seems like it was an effective way of approaching it because it is a very big subject.
Now, you had some mixed emotions about dealing with the Sicilian grandmothers, didn't you?
Yeah.
It
was interesting because all of the northern grandmothers warned me strongly about southern Italy, mostly in terms of just safety, being a very young single woman traveling. And so there was a little bit of kind of trepidation on my behalf, or I was a little more wary. And then I think that the Sicilians, in my experience, incredibly lively and vibrant. It also took me more time to develop the relationship. The type of closeness that developed wasn't as kind of open or as intimate as with some of the other women. And so I just had a harder time feeling comfortable and
yeah, you actually write that you were beginning to be very uncomfortable just before you took off for the island off of Palermo.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was sort of all, I was living in a garage that, you know, you press this button and the garage door would sort of lurch down, and that was my, that was where I was staying. It was all a little uncomfortable, but
well, it's a strange country. You know, when I was in school there, the northern Italians didn't even believe that Sicily was Italian.
I think the Sicilians don't think it's Italian either.
Yeah, this is true, too. But there's so many people. The culture is really much more complicated than as a corridor country than a lot of the northern regions.
Well, we should go on and talk about your next project. Your next project, I think, is all the things you left out of this book.
No, but I wanted her to say, this is not fair to ask us. If I wanted you to pick one character or two characters or three characters with just a snapshot.
From the book.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, and one thing I wanted to say about Sicily is, just to finish that, is that it's an incredible place. I think that it's a place that actually merits more like a year. Like, I could have spent a whole year in Sicily itself, and so there's that, too. I think it's just a place that I was wanting to spend more time in to really know. In terms of the snapshots, Irene comes to mind. She said something to me one day when I was staying with her. We were making the bagna cauda, which is a traditional Piemontese dish, the warm anchovy garlic dip
that's known to be the
dish of friendship fall days. In cozy ways with candlelight, by candlelight. And she said to me, you know, to understand something, you have to look at its root. And so this is just a very profound thing in terms of food and also in terms of life. Where does, in the case of the bagna cauda, where do the ingredients come from? The cardo gobo, the hunchback cardoon, is the sort of typical quintessential vegetable that's dipped into the bagna cauda, and that has its own history. And then there's also a history of the trade routes between the Piedmont and Liguria, by which the salt-packed anchovies came to the Piedmont. And so there's this whole history, and in understanding the dish, it's so helpful and enlivening to really understand its roots and to look back in that way. So Irene was incredible because she's a very deep person. You know, she's a psychotherapist and an amazing cook, and she'd been a teacher. She was involved in local politics. So that way for me that she talked about food and life and both went together in such a close way, I just loved that about her.
Wow.
And her food was like that.
But these people are amazing, these women that you discovered. And it was not really a well-thought-out plan to start with, was it?
No.
But you ended up with really great material, And I mean, we'll just have to go get it, because there's no way to encapsulate all the richness of your content in this book. Not to mention the delicious recipes.
Well, as we say goodbye, let's do the website again for us, Jessica.
It's cookingwithitaliangrandmothers.com, and then I have my own website that's sort of in progress, which is jessicathoreau.com.
Through that, you do consultation in healing foods, right?
Yes, exactly. And then there's also going to be more of my documentary work on that site.
Well, keep us posted, Jessica. You are
so difficult
to follow. You, so many things going on.
It's been great talking.
Yeah, great talking to you. And congratulations on a really beautifully realized project.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, once again, we hope you're going to have a happy Easter, that you've done all the planning to make that possible. If not, there's still time to implement the ideas that are included in this week's program. So until the same place, same time next week.
Bye-bye.